Who?
Play a let, babe. Do it over. 2 serves, 1 point.
Aubrey DeLint was a lightly pockmarked man, with thick yellow hair in an anchorman's helmety style, and a hypertensive flush, and eyes, oval and close-set and lightless, that seemed like a second set of nostrils in his face.
Do a whole lot of sports at moment, do you?
So they're being sporting,
Steepley said.
Generous. Fair.
We inculcate that as a priority here, DeLint said, gesturing vaguely at the space around them, head bent to his charts.
They seem like friends.
The angle here for moment might be the good friends off the court and remorseless, pitiless foes on court angle.
I mean, they seem like friends even playing,
Helen Steepley said, watching Hound dry off his leather grip with a white towel as Stice jumped up and down in place, back at his deuce corner, one hand in his armpit. DeLint's laugh sounded to Steepley's keen ear, like the laugh of a much older and less fit man. The mucoidal fist-at-chest laugh of a lap-blanketed old man in a lawn chair on his gravel backyard in Scottsdale, Arizona, hearing his son say his wife claimed no longer to know who he was.
Don't kid yourself, babe, DeLint got out.
The Vaught twins on the bleacher below looked up and around and pretended to shush him, the left mouth grinning, DeLint with that bad, cold-eyed shard of a smile back at them as Hallen Condenza bounced the ball 3 times and went into his own service motion. Several little boys were strung busily out along the sides of a small utility tunnel 26 meters below the show courts. Steepley's face looked as if the journalist were trying to think of pithy images for a motion as unexceptional and fluid as Hallen Condenza's serve. At the start, a violinist, maybe, standing alert with his sleek head cocked and racket up in front and the hand with the ball at the racket's throat like a bow. The down-together, up-together of the downswing and toss could be a child making angels in the snow, cheeks rosy and eyes at the sky. But Hal's face was pale and thoroughly unchildlike, his gaze somehow extending only 0.5 meter in front of him. He looked nothing like the punter. The service motion's middle might be a man at a precipice, falling forward, giving in sweetly to his own weight, and the serve's terminus and impact a hammering man, the driven nail just within range at the top of his tiptoed reach. But all these were only parts, and made the motion seem segmented, when the smaller, crew-cutted, jowly boy was the one with the stuttered motion, the man of parts. Steepley had played tennis only 2 times, with his wife, and had felt ungainly and simian out there. The punter's discourses on the game had been lengthy but not much use. It was unlikely that any one game figured much in the entertainment. Hallen Condenza's first serve was a tactically aggressive shot, but not immediately identifiable as such. Stice wanted to serve so hard he could set himself up to put the ball away on the next shot, up at net. Hal's serve seemed to set in motion a much more involved mechanism, one that took several exchanges to reveal itself as aggressive. His first serve hadn't Stice's pace, but it had depth. Plus a topspin Hal achieved with an arched back and faint brushing action over the back of the ball that made the serve curve visibly in the air, egg-shaped with spin, to land deep in the box and hop up high so that Stice couldn't do more than send back a deep backhand chip from shoulder height, and then couldn't come in behind a return that had been robbed of all pace. Stice moved to the baseline center as the chip floated back to Hal. Hal's pivot moved him right so he could take it on the forehand.
268.
Another looper dripping with top, right back in the same corner he'd served to, so that Stice had to stop and sprint back the same way he'd come. Stice drove this backhand hard down the line to Hal's forehand, a blazing thing that made the audience inhale. But as the Samizdat director's other son glided a few strides left, Steepley could see that he now had a whole open court to hit cross-court into, Stice having hit so hard he'd backpedaled a bit off the shot and was now scrambling to get back out of the deuce corner. And Hal hit the flat textbook drive cross-court into green-lined space. Hard, but not flamboyantly so, and the diagonal of the ball kept the traveling out wide after it hit Stice's ad sideline, carrying it away from the boy in black's outstretched racket, And for a second it looked as if Stice, at a dead run, might get his strings on the ball, but the ball stayed, tantalizingly, just out of reach, still traveling at a severe cross-court diagonal, and it passed Stice's racket half a meter past its rim, and Stice's momentum carried him almost halfway into the next court. Stice slowed to a jog to go retrieve the ball. Hal stood slightly hip-shot on the ad side, waiting for Stice to get back and let him serve again. DeLint, whose peripheral vision's acuity and disguise was an ETA legend, observed the big journalist chew her nib for a second and then put down nothing more than the Greg ideogram for pretty, shaking her fuchsia cap.
"Wasn't that pretty?" he said blandly.
Steeply rooted for a hanky.
"Not exactly."
"Hal's in essence a torturer, if you want his essence as a player, instead of a straight-out killer like Stice or the Canadian Wayne," DeLint said. "This is why you don't stay back or play safe against Hal. This way of the ball seeming just in reach, to keep you trying, running, he yanks you around. Always two or three shots ahead. He won that point on the deep forehand after the serve. The second he had Stice wrong-footed, you could see the angle open up. Although the serve set the whole thing up in advance, and without the risk of much pace on it. The kid doesn't need pace, we've helped him find."
"When might I get a chance to talk to him?"
"In condenser took a lot of bringing along. He didn't used to quite have the complete game to be able to do this. Slice the cord up into sections and chinks, then all of a sudden you see light through one of the chinks, and you see he's been setting up the angle since the start of the point. It makes you think of chess."
The journalist blew her red nose.
"Chess on the run."
"Nice term."
Hal went into his service motion to the ad court.
"Do the students play chess here?"
A mirthless chuckle.
"No time."
"Do you play chess?"
Stice hit a backhand winner off Hal's second serve. Mild applause.
"I don't have time to play anything," DeLint said, filling in a square.
You could tell by the sound that the other boy's racket was strung tighter than Hal's.
"When do I get to sit down with Hal directly?"
"I don't know. I don't think you do."
The journalist's rapid head movement reconfigured the flesh of her neck.
"Pardon me?"
"It's not my decision. My guess is you don't. Dr. Tavis didn't already tell you?"
"I really couldn't tell what he was telling me."
"We've never had a kid here interviewed. The founder let you guys on the grounds. Versus Tavis, this is an exception. You're even getting in."
"I'm here for background only. For your alumnus, the punter."
DeLint was making his lips look like he was whistling, even though no whistling sound was emerging.
"We've never let somebody do any kind of interview on a kid here while he's still in training and inculcation."
"Does the student have some sort of say in who he talks to and why? What if the boy wants to chat with me about his brother's transition from tennis to football?"
DeLint kept his concentration on the match and the chart in a way that was supposed to let you know you had very little of his attention.
"I talked to Tavis about it."
"I was in there for over 2 hours.
"You pick up how to do questions with him after a while. Tavis, you have to back into a yes-no corner where you can finally say, 'I need a yes or a no.' It takes about 20 minutes if you're sharp. This is your whole business, getting answers out of people. The answer's not for me to officially say, but I'm guessing a no. The Boston press guys come around after a big event. They get match results and physical stats and hometowns and nothing more."
"Moment is a national magazine for and about exceptional people, not some sports writer with a cigar and a deadline."
"It's a command decision, babe. I'm not in command. I know they teach us to teach that this place is about seeing instead of being seen."
"I'm here only for the human interest perspective of a talented boy on his talented brother's bold transition to a major sport where he's shown himself to be even more talented. One exceptional brother on another. Hal is not the profile's focus."
"Get Tavis in the right corner and he'll tell you about seeing and being seen. These kids, the best of them, are here to learn to see. Schnitt's thing is self-transcendence through pain. These kids..." Gesturing at Stice, running madly up for a drop volley that stopped rolling well inside the service line. Mild applause. "They're here to get lost in something bigger than them. To have it stay the way it was when they started. The game is something bigger at first. Then they show talent, start winning, become big fish in their ponds out there in their hometowns, stop being able to get lost inside the game and see. Fucks with the junior's head, talent. They pay top dollar to come here and go back to being little fish, and they get savaged and feel small and see and develop. To forget themselves as objects of attention for a few years and see what they can do when the eyes are off them. They didn't come here to get read about as some soft news item or background, babe.
Delint read Steepley's expression as some kind of tick. The tiniest tuft of nostril hair protruded from one of her nostrils, which Delint found repellent. She said,
"Were you ever written about as a player?"
Delint smiled coolly at his charts.
"Never had the sort of ranking or promise this issue to even come up for me."
"But some of these do. Hal's brother did."
Delint felt along his lips outline with his pencil. Sniffed.
"Orin was okay. Orin was essentially a one-trick pony as a player. And between you and me and the fence, he was kind of a head case. His game left here on the downswing. Now his little brother's got a future in tennis if he wants. And Ortho. Wayne, for sure. Couple other girls. Kent, Karen, and Sharon here," indicating the Vaught apparition below them. "The really gifted ones, the ones that make it out of here still on the upswing, if they get to the show."
"Meaning professional, you mean?"
"And the show, they'll get all they want of being made into statues to be looked at and poked at and discussed, and then some. For now, they're here to get to be the ones who look and see and forget getting looked at. For now."
"But even you call it the show. They'll be entertainers."
"You bet your ass they will be."
"So audiences will be the whole point. Why not also prepare them for the stresses of entertaining an audience, get them used to being seen?"
The two boys were at the near net post, Stice blowing his nose into a towel. Delint made kind of a show of putting his clipboard down.
"Assume wrongly for a second that I can speak for the Enfield Academy. I say you do not get it. The point here for the best kids is to inculcate their sense that it's never about being seen. It's never. If they can get that inculcated, the show won't fuck them up," Stitt thinks. "If they can forget everything but the game when all of you out there outside the fence see only them and want only them, and the game's incidental to you, for you it's about entertainment and personality. It's about the statue. But if they can get inculcated right, they'll never be slaves to the statue. They'll never blow their brains out after winning an event when they win, or dive out a third-story window when they start to stop getting poked at or profiled, when their blossom starts to fade. Whether or not you mean to, babe, you chew them up. It's what you do."
"We chew statues?"
"Whether you mean to or no. You, moments, world tennis, self-interlace, the audiences, the crowds in Italy fucking literally. It's the nature of the game. It's the machine they're all dying to throw themselves into. They don't know the machine, but we do. Gerhardt's teaching them to see the ball out of a place inside that can't be chewed. It takes time and total focus. The man's a fucking genius. Profile Stitt if you want to profile somebody."
"And I'm not going to be allowed to even ask the students what it looks like, this inside, chew-proof place. It's a secret place."
Hal mishit a second serve, and it flew off his frame and way down to where the girls were sending each other squeaks and lobs. And Stice had now broken him to go up 6-5, and the murmurs in the bleachers were like a courtroom and an unpleasant revelation. Delint rounded his lips and made a kind of bovine sound in Ortho Stice's direction. Hal chipped his balls out along the baseline and made some small adjustments in his cross-hatched strings as he walked around for the side change. A couple of the nastier kids applauded Hal's mishit a little.
"Get sardonic with me all you want. I already said it's not my command decision. I wouldn't get sardonic with Tavis, though."
"But if it were your command?"
"Lady, if it was me, you'd be pressing your nose between the bars of the gate down there is as far in as you'd get.
You're coming into a little slice of space and or time that's been carved out to protect talented kids from exactly the kind of activities you guys come in here to do. Why Orin, anyway?
The kid appears 4 times a game, never gets hit, doesn't even wear pads. A one-trick pony. Why not John Wayne? A more dramatic story, geopolitics, privation, exile, drama. A better player than Hal, even. A more complete game. Aimed like a fucking missile at the show. Maybe the top 5 if he doesn't fuck up or burn down. Wayne's your ideal food group. Which is why we'll keep you off him as long as he's here. The soft profiler looked around at the scalps and knees in the stands, the bags of gear, and a couple incongruous cans of furniture polish.
Carved out of what, though? This place?
From the desk of Helen Steepley, contributing editor, Moment Magazine, 13473, Blasted Expanse Boulevard, Tucson, Arizona, 85704878-7/2. Mr. Marlon K. Bain, Saprogenic Greetings, Inc., BPL, Waltham, Building 1214, Totten Pond Road, Waltham, Massachusetts, 02154-9872/4. November, YDAU. Dear Mr. Bain, in Phoenix on other business, it has been my good fortune to meet your adolescent friend, Mr. Orin J. Incandenza, and to have become intrigued with the possibilities of a profile of the Incandenza family and its accomplishments, in not only sports but wide-ranging topics such as independent films circa metropolitan Boston, past and present. I am writing to ask for your cooperation in contacting you with questions which you could answer in writing, as I am informed by Mr. Orin Incandenza you dislike to meet people outside your home and office. I am hoping to hear from you in response to this request at your earliest convenience, etc., etc., etc. Saprogenic Greetings, a proud member of the Acme family of gags and notions. Will you care enough to let a professional say it for you? Prepackaged emotions, jokes, and surprises, and wacky disguises. Ms. Helen Steepley and so on. November, YDAU. Dear Ms. Steepley, fire away. VD. M.K. Bain, Saprogenic Greetings, /Acme. From the desk of Helen Steepley, contributing editor, Moment Magazine, 13473 Blasted Expanse Boulevard, Tucson, Arizona, 85704878-7/2. Mr. M.K. Bain, Saprogenic Greetings, Inc., BPL, Waltham, Building 1214, Totten Pond Road, Waltham, Massachusetts, 02154987/4, November, YDAU. Dear Mr. Bain, question, 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 question.
269.
Carved out of sedimentary shale and ferrous granite and generic morphic crud, at more or less the same time the hilltop's bulge was shaved off and rolled and impacted level for tennis, are ETA's abundant tunnels. There are access tunnels and hallway tunnels with rooms and labs and pump rooms, lung nexus off both sides, utility tunnels and storage tunnels, and little blunt off tunnels connecting tunnels to other tunnels. Maybe about 16 different tunnels in all, in a shape that's more generally ovoid than anything else. The 11th of November, 1625 hours. Lamont Chu, Josh Gopnik, Audern Talat Kelpsa, Philip Traub, Tim Sleepy T.P. Peterson, Carl Whale, Kieran McKenna, the bulk of the ambulatory sub-14 male Eskatonites, plus 10-year-old Kent Blott, are 26 meters directly below the Hal/Darkness matches show court with Glad handle tie trash bags
270
and BP low diffusion compact mercuric flashlights. Plus, Chew has a clipboard with a pen attached to its clamp with twine. The sounds of competitive sneaker movement and spectatorial bleacher squeaks on the surface, traveling down through meters of compacted crud and polymerized cement tunnel ceiling with parquet layer, sound rather like the stealthy dry scuttle of rodents, vermin. And this heightens the excitement that's part of why they're really down here. One part of the reason they're down here is that small U.S. boys seem to have this fetish for getting down
in the enclosed fundaments underneath things. Tunnels, caves, ventilator shafts, the horrific areas beneath wooden porches. Rather the way older U.S. boys like great perspectival heights and spectacular views encompassing huge swaths of territory. This latter fetish accounting for why ETA's hilltop site is one of its trump cards in the recruiting war with Port Washington and other eastern seaboard academies. Another part is a semi-punitive shit detail in which certain players, judged to have been involved in the recent Eschaton non-strategic combat debacle, but who are uninjured,
271,
and not in the much severer hot water that the big buddies on the scene are in, have been punitively remanded below ground in PM shifts on what's supposed to constitute an unpleasant chore. To scout out the tunneled route, the Testar All-Weather Inflatable Structures Corporation's professional guys will have to take as they haul out from the lung storage room the fiberglass struts and cross pieces and dendrourethane folds that compose the lung for erection of the lung when the ETA administration finally decides that the late fall weather has gone beyond character building and become an impediment to development and morale. This will be soon. Because the pro-rectors live in rooms off the larger tunnels and FDV Hardy's physical plant and maintenance guys have their offices and supplies down here, and because Dr. James and Candenza's old optics and editing facilities are down here off one of the main tunnels, I get used for Leith Ogilvy classes in entertainment production and for optical science tutorials, etc., and because a couple of the secondary and off tunnels are used for temporary storage by departing seniors who can't tote 8 or more years' worth of accumulated stuff in one postgraduate load, especially if they jet off to some novitiate pro satellite circuit for the summer, because that means air travel, 2 bags plus gear max, some of the tunnels become badly littered in the warm season with trash-type material. And sometimes there's bulky possession-type overflow from the little curved storage tunnels off the pro-rector's hallway. Smaller kids are perfect for recons into low, narrow tunnels, partly blocked with dross. And even though it's no secret around ETA that the smaller boys spend a fair amount of time down in the tunnels anyway, a retributive aspect is lent to this recon detail by making the kids take down handle-tie trash bags to clear away littered exam papers and lab handouts, calculator batteries and banana peels, and Kodiak smokeless tobacco tins, and spirals of synthetic gut racket string, and maintenance guy's hideous cigar butts. Sleepy TP finds 2 bright Trojan wrappers just off the Prorector's hallway tunnel, and then a couple meters farther along the floor, the vermiform gleam of an actual condom. And there's some high register debate about whether it's a used condom or not. And poor old Kent Blott is finally put in charge of picking it up and putting it in a trash bag, just in case it's a used condom. And empty boxes of complimentary corporate gear, and full boxes of faggy or poorly absorbent gear nobody wants, and Habitant can wrappers, and senior trunks, and dorm-sized fridgelets, etc. And also to move whatever boxes they can heft, clear them out of the Testar guy's access route into the lung storage and pump rooms. And Lamont Chu is supposed to note the location of any boxes or objects too bulky for them to move out of the way, and beefy custodial guys will be dispatched to handle them as they see fit. This is why a fair number of the smaller ETA males don't see Stice take a set off Hal and Candenza and nearly beat him, is that they were remanded down here by Neil Hartigan right after post-conditioning showers. As noted already, they don't much mind it, being down here, now in one of the child-size, diametered, off-tunnels between the pro-rector's hallway and the lung storage room. The Eschatonites are down here quite a lot anyway. In fact, the sub-14 ETAs historically have a kind of tunnel club. Like many small boys' clubs, the tunnel club's unifying raison d'etre is kind of vague. Tunnel club activities mostly involve congregating informally in the better-lit main tunnels and hanging out and catching each other in lies about their lives and careers before ETA, and recapitulating the most recent Eschaton, usually only about 5 a term, and the club's only formal activity is sitting around with a yellowed copy of Robert's Rules, endlessly refining and amending the rules for who can and can't join the Tunnel Club. A true boy-type club, the Tunnel Club's least vague raison d'etre has to do with exclusion. The vital no-girls exclusion is the only ironclad part of the Tunnel Club's charter.
272.
With the exception of Kent Blott, every boy down here on this detail is an Eschatonite and a member of the Tunnel Club. Kent Blott, ineligible for Eschaton because he's a humanities-type kid and hasn't even taken quadrivial algebra yet, and excluded from the club under every incarnation of the eligibility requirements thus far, is down here solely because he was heard to maintain at lunch that he was in the north part of the main tunnel between the ComEd locker rooms and the subterranean laundry room this a.m., shortcutting back to his room in West House after drills and a sauna, and claimed to have espied, scuttling out of his mercuric light toward one of the secondary tunnels to subdorms C and D and the East Courts and this same general tunnel area they're now in, to have sighted what was either a rat or, he said, what looked even more like a concavitated feral hamster. So, the Eschatonites are also enthusiastic to be down here for potential rodent recon, checking out Blott's claim, and they brought what's either a very nervous or very excited Blott down with them, so they can trace the possible routes Blott said he saw the rodent maybe take, filling their glad handle ties and noting heavy items along the way, and also so they can immediately encircle and discipline Kent Blott if it turns out he was yanking people's chains. Plus, they make Blott be the one to take full trash bags and tie their plastic handles together and drag them back to where the expedition started, the entrance to the large, smooth main tunnel by the boys' sauna, since none of them enjoys dragging full trash bags solo through dark tunnels with the rodential squeaking of match play and spectation far above. Chu holds a penlight in his teeth and writes heavy stuff down. They filled several bags and gotten a lighter shit stacked off back enough to create a narrow route almost all the way to the pump room, around which room hangs a strange, sweet, stale, burny smell that none of them can place. The applause, as Howling Condensa barely takes the first set, above, sounds down here like faraway rain. The off-tunnel's dark as a pocket, but warm and dry, and there's surprisingly little dust. Ducts and coaxials running along the low ceiling make Whale and Talat Kelpsa have to crouch as they walk point, clearing boxes and trying unsuccessfully to move fridgelets back out of the way. There are several pockets of small but heavy, dorm-sized Maytag fridgelets, the kind of thing no graduate takes with him, paneled in dark wood-grain plastic, some of them old models with three-prong plugs instead of chargers. Some of the empty fridgelets have been indifferently scrubbed out and have their doors partway open and smell stale. Most of Chu's inventory for beefy adult removal are either fridgelets or locked trunks, full of what sound like magazines and 8-year-old accumulations of pennies. The muffled rodential squeak of sneakers far overhead excites the Tunnel Club boys and puts them on edge. Philip Traub keeps making little squeaky noises and secretly tickling the back of people's necks, causing enormous excitement and much stopping and starting and tightly enclosed whirling around, until Kieran McKenna captures Traub tickling Josh Gopnik in the bright beam of his PB light, and Gopnik punches Traub in the radial nerve, and Traub clutches his arm and weeps and says he's quitting and going topside. Traub's the youngest kid here except for Blott, and is a probationary second-string launcher in most eschatons. And they have to stop and let you note and mark two discarded fridgelets while Peterson and Gopnik try to distract and amuse Traub into staying and not retreating back up to Nwangi and making a high-pitched stink. Discarded fridgelets, empty boxes, immovable and complexly addressed labeled trunks, used athletic tape and ace bandages, the occasional empty Visine bottle, which Blott stashes in his sweatshirt pouch for Mike Pemulis's next contest, Optics 1 and 2 lab reports, broken ball machines and stray tennis balls too dead even for the repressurization machine, broken or discarded TP cartridges of stroke analysis filmings or worn-out entertainments, an anomalous set of parfait glasses, fruit peels, and AminoPal energy bar wrappers that the club itself had left down here after meetings, discarded curls of grip and tensile string, several incongruous barrettes, several old broadcast televisions some older kids used to like to keep around to watch the static, and, along the seam of wall and floor, brittle, limb-shaped husks of exfoliated pledge, expanses of arm and leg already half-decayed into fragrant dust. This comprising the bulk of the crud down here, and the kids don't much mind scanning and inventorying and bagging it, because their minds are diverted by something else, very exciting. A kind of possible raison d'etre for the club itself. Unless Blot had been tweaking their units, in which case, look out, Blot, is the consensus. Gopnik to a sniffling Traub, while Peterson shines his flashlight on the clipboard for Chew. Mary had a little lamb, its fleece electrostatic, and everywhere that Mary went, the lights became erratic. Carl Whale pretends to be immensely fat and moves along the wall with a blimpish, splay-legged waddle. Peterson to Traub, while Gopnik holds the light. 18-year-old top-ranked John Wayne had sex with Herr Stitt on a train. They had sex again, and again and again, and again and again and again. Which the slightly older kids find more entertaining than Traub does. Kent Blott asks why a wispy-dicked blubberer like Phil gets to be in the Tunnel Club, while his own applications get turned down. And Talat Kelpsa cuts him short by doing something to him in the dark that makes Blott shriek. It's utterly dark, except for the dime-sized discs of their low-diffusion BPs, because they've left the tunnel strings of bare overhead bulbs off, because Gopnik, who's originally from Brooklyn and knows from rodents, says only a complete booger-eating moron would do rat reconnaissance in the light, and it seems reasonable to assume that feral hamsters also have a basically ratty attitude toward light. Chew has Blot see whether he can lift a bulky, old, doorless microwave oven that's lying on its side, up next to one wall, and Blot tries, and barely lifts it, and pules. And Chew marks the oven down for the adults to lift, and tells Blot to drop it, which invitation Blot takes literally, and the crash and tinkle infuriate Gopnik and McKenna, who say that scanning for rodents with Blot is like fly fishing with an epileptic, which cheers Traub up quite a bit. Feral hamsters, bogey-wise right up there with mile-high toddlers, skull-deprived wraiths, carnivorous flora, and marsh gas that melts your face off and leaves you with exposed gray and red facial musculature for the rest of your ghoulish pariah life in terms of late-night hair-raising concavity narratives, are rarely sighted south of the Lucite walls and ATH-SCME'd checkpoints that delimit the gray concavity. And only once in a blue moon anywhere south of, like, the new border burg of Methuen, Massachusetts, whose Chamber of Commerce calls it the city that interdependence rebuilt. And anyway, Pache Blot are hardly ever seen solo, being the sort of rapacious, locust-like, mass-movement creature that Canadian agronomists call piranha of the plains. An infestation of feral hamsters in the waste-rich terrain of Metro Boston, to say nothing of the clutter-tunneled ETA grounds, would be an almost grand-scale public health disaster, would cause simply no end of adult running in circles and knuckle-biting, and would consume mega-calories of displaced pre-adolescent stress for the ETA players. Every ear-cocked, eye-peeled, bag-toting kid in the off-tunnel this afternoon is hoping hamster in a big way, except for Kent Blott, who's hoping simply and fervently for some sort of rodential sighting or scat sample that'll keep him from being disciplinarily hung upside down in a lavatory stall to shriek until a staff member finds him. He reminds the tunnel clubbers that it's not like he'd claimed he espied the thing actually heading in this direction. He'd only seen the thing scuttling in a way that seemed to suggest a tendency or, like, probability of heading in this direction. one whole box on its side with its frayed strapping tape split, a spilled part of a load of old TP cartridges, old and mostly unlabeled, out onto the tunnel floor in a fannish pattern. And Gopnik and Peterson complained that the cartridge cases' sharp edges put holes in their glad bags, and Blot is dispatched with 3 bags of cartridges and fruit rinds, each only about half full, back to the lit vestibule outside the ComAd tunnel start, where a serious pile of bags is starting to pile fragrantly up. Plus, a confirmed feral hamster sighting, Chew and Gopnik and STP Peterson have agreed, could well distract the headmaster's office from post-eschaton reprisals against Big Buddies Pemulus, Incandenza, and Axford, whom the club's eschatonite faction doesn't want to see reprised against, particularly. Though the consensus is nobody would much mind seeing the malefic Anne Kitten plan hung out to dry in a serious way. Plus, hamster incursions could be posited to account for the occult appearance of large and incongruous ETA objects in inappropriate places, which started in August with the thousands of practice balls found scattered all over the blue lobby carpeting and the carefully arranged pyramid of Amino Pal energy bars found on court number 6 at Dawn Drills in mid-September, and has gained momentum in a way no one cares for one bit, feral hamsters being notorious draggers and rearrangers of stuff they can't eat but feel compelled to fuck with anyway, somehow. And so ease the communal near-hysteria the objects have caused among aboriginal blue-collar staff and sub-16 ETA alike. Which would make the Tunnel Club guys something like heroes, foreseeably. They move along the tunnel, their mercuric lights crossing and separating and forming jagged angles, colored faintly pink. But even a confirmed rat would be a coup. Dean of Academic Affairs, Mrs. Ink, has a violent phobic thing about vermin and waste and insects and overall facility hygiene. And Orkin men with beer bellies and playing cards with naked girls and high-heeled shoes on the backs, McKenna's claim, spray the bejesus out of the ETA grounds twice a semester. None of the younger ETA boys, who have the same post-latency fetish for vermin they have about subterranean access and exclusive clubs, none of them has ever once gotten to see or trap a rat or roach or even so much as a lousy silverfish anyplace around here. So the unspoken consensus is that a hamster'd be optimal, but they'd settle for a rat. Just one lousy rat could give the whole club a legit raison, an explicable reason for congregating underground. All of them are a bit uneasy about liking to congregate underground, for no good or clear reason. Sleeps, you think you could lift that and carry it? Chew, man, I wouldn't even get up next to whatever that is, much less touch it. Lots of footfalls and tuneless whistling can be heard from far away, returning, and the distant squeak of overhead sneakers. Gopnik stops and his light pans playing on faces. Okay, somebody farted. What's this up next to it, Sleeps? Chew, backing up to widen his light's beam on something broad and squat and dark. Can I get some lights over here on this, you guys? Because did somebody go ahead and cut one in this little unventilated space? Chew, it's a room fridge, that's all. But it's bigger than the room fridges. But it's not as big as a real fridge. It's in between. I do smell something, though, Gop, I admit. There is a smell. If somebody farted, speak up. Otherwise, it's a smell. Don't try to describe it. Sleeps. That's no human fart I've ever smelled. It's too powerful for a fart. Maybe Teddy Shocked was having an attack and staggered down here just to cut one. Peterson trains his light on the mid-sized brown fridge. You don't possibly think. Chew says, no way. No way. What? Blot says. Don't even think it, Chew says. I don't even think any kind of mammal could fart that bad, Chew. Peterson's looking at Chew, both of their faces pale in the mercuric light. No way somebody'd graduate and leave and put their fridge down here without taking the food out. Blot goes, is that the smell? Was this Pearson's fridge last year? Sleepy TP turns around. Who smells a, like, Like decay element. Lights on the tunnel ceiling from upraised hands. Quorum on decay type odor. Should we check? Chu says. Lot's hamster might be in there. Gnawing on something unspeakable, maybe.
You mean open it?
Pearson had a bigger than usual fridge.
Open it?
Chu scratches behind his ear. Me and Goppel light it up. Peterson opens it.
Why me?
Your closest sleeps. Hold your breath.
Jesus.
Well, back off up here so I can jump way back if anything, like, flies out.
Nobody could be so low. Who would go off and leave a full fridge?
Happy to back way, way off, says Carl Whale, his light receding. Not even Pearson could be that low, leaving food in an unplugged fridge. This could explain rodent attraction and then some. Now look out. Ready?
Ow, get off! Put the light over... Oh, my God! Oh, my God! Such a smell I'm smelling! There's mayonnaise! Oh, he left mayonnaise in there! Why, the bulge in the top of the lid? The ballooning carton of orange juice! Nothing could live in that, rodent or otherwise.
So why is that sandwich meat moving?
Maggots? Maggots! Shut it! Sleeps! Oh, kick it shut!
This right here is exactly as close as I'm ever getting to that fridge ever again, Chu.
The smell's expanding.
I can smell it from here,
Whale's tiny distant voice.
I'm not enjoying this at all. This is death. Woe to those that gazeth on death. The Bible.
What are maggots? Should we just run really fast the other way?
Second that.
This is probably what the rat or hamster smelled, Blot ventures.
Run!
High receding voices, bobbing lights. Whale's light way out front. After Stison and Candenza split the first two sets and Hal dashed into the locker room at the break to put Collyrium brand eyewash in eyes that were bothering him, and Delint made warped crashing sounds on the tiers as he walked down the bleachers and over to have a word with Stice, who was squatting against the net post, holding his left arm up like a scrubbed surgeon and applying a towel to the arm. Delint's place up next to Helen Steepley was taken by female pro-rector Terry Poutrincourt. Freshly showered, long-faced, a non-U.S. citizen, a tall Quebecer, former satellite pro in rimless specs, and a violetish ski cap just enough of a shade away from the journalist's hat to make the people behind them pretend to shield their eyes from the clash. The putative newshound introduced herself and asked Poutrincourt who the heavy-browed kid was at the end of the top bleacher behind them, hunched over and gesturing and speaking into his empty fist.
James Trocha Philadelphia is better to leave alone to play the broadcaster to himself.
He is strange and unhappy,
Poutrincourt said, her face long and cavern-cheeked and not terribly happy-looking itself. Her slight shrugs and way of looking elsewhere while speaking were not unlike Remy Marat's.
When we hear you are the journalist for shiny perfumed magazines of fad and trend, we are told to be unfriendly. But me, I think I am friendly.
Her smile was rictal and showed confused teeth.
My family's loved ones are also large of size.
It is difficult to be large.
Steepley's pre-assignment decision was to let all size references pass, as if there was some ability to screen out any reference to size or girth, originating possibly in adolescence.
Your Mr. DeLint certainly held himself aloof.
DeLint, when we pro-rectors are suggested to do a thing, he asks to himself only, how can I perfectly do this thing, so the superiors will smile with pleasure at DeLint?
Poutrincourt's right forearm is almost twice the size of her left. She wore white sneakers and a Donny warm-up of a deep, glowing neutron blue that clashed hideously with both their caps. The circles beneath her eyes were also blue.
Why the instructions to be unfriendly?
Poutrincourt always nodded for a while before she replied to anything, as if things had to go through various translation circuits. She nodded and scratched at her long jaw, thinking.
You are here to make publicity a child player, one of our étoiles.
273.
And Dr. Tavis, he is, how you say, quantified.
Quarantined? suspicious, guarded, no, confused, torn in a quandary.
Quandary is how. Because this is a good place, and Hurley's good. Better since before the present. Perhaps now he is étoile.
A shrug. Long arms akimbo. Hal reemerged from ComEd, and, ankle brace or no, displayed a slow, loose, thoroughbred trot past the pavilion and bleachers, and to the gate, and number 12's southern fence, acting as if unwatched by people in bleachers, and tapped two of his big-headed tennis rackets together to listen for the string's pitch, exchanging some neutral words with Delent, who was standing with Stice at the edge of the transom's shadow. Stice breaking into a half-laugh at something, twirling his racket, and walking back to serve, as Hal retrieved a ball along the north fence. Both players' rackets had large heads and thick frames. Terry Poutrincourt said, "And by nature who does not wish the shiny attention? That the magazines with Cologne on their pages say this is étoile? Enfield Tennis Academy, it is good?"
"I'm here to do a soft, inoffensive profile on his brother, with Hal mentioned only as part of an American family, exceptional in several respects. I don't see what's quandariacal for Dr. Tavis about this."
The tiny, plump, officious man who seemed to have a phone tucked under his chin at all times. The kind of frenzied over-cooperation that's a technical interviewer's worst nightmare for an interrogation. The little man's monologue had done to Steepley's brain kind of what a flashbulb does to your eyes, and if he'd explicitly denied him access to the brother, then the denial had been slipped in after he'd worn Steepley down. There was the slight shaken-saw wobble of bleachers as Delint walked back up, stacked charts against his chest like a schoolgirl's books. His smile at the Quebecois player in his seat as if he'd never met her before, settling in heavily on Steepley's other side, glancing down at where the profiler had bracketed notes on the possible sounds a string-hit ball sounds like in cold air. Cut, king, ping, pons, puck, cup, thwa, thwat. The Samizdat Entertainment's director's other son chipped a return that caught the tape and sat there a moment and fell back.
"Veux-vous que nous parlons en français? Serait plus facile ça?"
This invitation because Poutrincourt's eyes had gone hooded the minute the Delint person joined them. Poutrincourt's shrug was blasé. Francophones are never impressed that anyone else can speak French. "Very well, then, look," she said. Poutrincourt did in Quebecois. "Pubescent stars are nothing new to this sport. Langlen, Roswell. In AD 1887, a 15-year-old girl won Wimbledon. She was the first. Everett in the semifinals of the U.S. Open at 16, 71 or 2. Austin, Jaeger, Graf, Sawamatsu, Venus Williams, Borg, Willander, Chang, Treffert, Medvedev, Escogna, Becker of the AD 80s. Now this new Argentinian, Kleckner." Steeply lit a flounder fume that made Delint's face spread with distaste.
"You compare it as like gymnastics, figure skating, competitive to swim."
Poutrincourt made no comment on Steeply's syntax.
"Just so then. Good."
Steeply was adjusting the long peasant skirt and crossing legs so he was inclined away from Delint, gazing at a kind of translucent mole on Poutrincourt's long cheek. Poutrincourt's thick, rimless specs were like a scary nun's. She looked more male than anything, long and hard and breastless. Steeply tried to exhale away from everyone.
"The word plateau tennis not being required to have neither the size and muscle of the hockey nor the basketball, nor the American football, for example."
Poutrincourt nodded.
"But yes, nor the millimetric precision of your best ball's hitting? Nor have the Italians say the sensorori, the never-miss consistency that keeps their golfers from true mastery until they have 30 or more years."
The prorector switched for just a moment to English, possibly for Delint's benefit.
"Your French is Parisian but passable. Me, mine is Quebecois."
Steeply now got to give that same sour Gallic shrug.
You're saying to me serious tennis doesn't need of an athlete anything already adolescents do not possess, if they are exceptional for it.
The medicinists of sports science know well what taught tennis requires, Poutrincourt said, back in French. Too well which are the agility, the reflexes.
274.
The short-range speed, the balance, some coordination between the hand and the eye, and very much endurance. Some strength, with particular importance for the male. But all these are achievable by the period of puberty for some. But yes. But wait, she said, putting a hand on the notebook as Steeply started to pretend to inscribe. The thing you have put as the question to me, this is why the quandary. The young players, they have the advantage in psyche, also.
The edge of mentality, Steeply said, trying to ignore the boy speaking into his hand several seats over.
DeLint seemed to be ignoring everything around him, engrossed in the match and his statistics. The Canadian pro-rector's hands moved in small circles out front to indicate engagement in the conversation.
Americans' conversational hands sit like lumps of dough most of the time, Rémy Marat had pointed out once.
But yes, so the formidable mental edge that our psyches are still not yet adult in all ways. Therefore, so, they do not feel the anxiety and pressure in the way it is felt by adult players. This is our story of the teenager appearing from no location to upset the famous adult in professional play. The ephebic. They do not feel the pressure. They can play with abandon. They are without fear.
A cold smile. Sunlight blazed on her lenses. At the beginning
they are without pressure or fear. And they burst from seemingly no location onto the professional stage. Instant étoile. Phenomenal. Phyllis. Immunized to pressure. Numb to anxiety. At first. They seem as if they are like the adult players, only better. Better in emotion. More abandoned. Not human to the stress or fatigue of their airplaning without end. To the publicity.
The English expression of the child in the store of candy.
Seemingly unfeeling of the loneliness and alienation, and everyone wants a thing from the étoile.
The money also.
But it is soon you start to see the burning out which the place like ours is hoping to prevent. You remember Jaeger? Burned out at 16. Austin at 20. Arias and Krickstein. Esconia and Treffet. Too injured to play on by their late teenage years. The much-promising Capriati. The well-known tragedy. Pat Cash of Australia. Fourth on Earth at 18. Vanished by the 20s of age.
Not to be mentioning the large money. The endorsings and appearings.
Always so for the young étoile. And now worse than today, that the sponsors have no broadcasting to advertise with. Now the Ephib, who is famous étoile, who is in magazines, on the sports reports au disque, he is pursued to become the billboard who walks. Use this, wire this, for money. Millions thrown at you before you can drive the cars you buy. The head swells to the size of a balloon. Why not?
But can pressure be far behind the back? Steeply said.
Many times the same. Winning 2 and 3 upset matches, feeling suddenly so loved, so many talking to you as if there is love. But always the same, then. For then you awaken to the fact that you are loved for winning only. The 2 and 3 wins created you for people. It is not that the wins made them recognize something that existed unrecognized before these upset wins. The from-no-place winning created you. You must keep winning to keep the existence of love and endorsements and the shiny magazines wanting your profile.
Enter the pressure, Steeply said.
Pressure such as one could not imagine. Now that to maintain, you must win. Now that winning is the expected, and all alone, in the hotels, on the airplanes,
with any other player you could speak to of the pressure to exist wanting to beat you, wanting to be exist above and not below. All the others, wanting from you, and only so long as you play with abandon, winning.
Hence the suicides, the burnout, the drugs, the self-indulging, the spoilage.
What is the instruction if we shape the Ephebe into the athlete who can win fearlessly to be loved, yet we do not prepare her for the time after fear comes? No?
Therefore the terrible pressure here. They are being tempered, oven toughened.
Hal served wide and this time followed it in, the serve, taking a stutter step at the service line. Stice's body seemed to elongate as he reached and got the stick up over the return, driving a forehand. Hal volleyed it too short and took a couple steps off the net as Stice came in, winding up for an easy pass. Hal guessed a direction and started to his left, and the darkness chipped a lob right over him and hit the heel of his hand against his strings as Hal gave it up halfway back, Stice not rubbing it in but exhorting himself. Hal's sweat was way heavier than the Kansans, but Stice's face was almost maroon with flush. Each player twirled his stick in his hand as Hal walked back to retrieve the ball. Stice took his position in the deuce court, pulling up his socks. Still smart for Hal to follow the serve in once a game or so, Dylan said into Steeply's ear. And irritating throughout was the heavy-browed, red-nostriled kid, James Trulch, at the very end of the top bleacher, speaking into his fist, coming at the fist from first one angle and then another, pretending to be two people.
In Cadenza the controller. In Cadenza the tactician. Rare tactical lapse for Incandenza, following the serve in when he's just finally started establishing control from the baseline. Have a look at Incandenza standing there waiting for Ortho Stice to finish futzing with his socks so he can serve. The resemblance to statues of Augustus of Rome. The regal bearing, the set of the head, the face impassive and emanating command, the chilly blue eyes. The chilly reptilian film of concentration in the cold blue eyes, Jim. The Halster's been having some trouble controlling his volleys. Personally, Jim, I think he'd be better off with his old mid-sized graphite stick than that large head the creepy Dunlop guy got him to switch to. Stice being the younger player out there, he's grown up with the extra-large head. A large head is all the darkness knows. You could say Stice was born with a large head, and that Incandenza's a man who's adapted his game to a large head. Hal's career dating back to before your polycarbonate resins changed the whole power matrix of the junior game, too, Jim. And what a day for tennis. What a day for family fun of all kinds. This bud's for the whole family. It's the bud match of the week, brought to you. Incandenza even reported to have modified his grip, all to accommodate the large head. And by the multiphasics family of fine graphite-reinforced polycarbonate resins, Ray. Jim, Ortho Stice, impossible to even visualize Stice without his trusty large head. It's all they know, these kids. Delint hiked back onto an elbow on the tier above and told James Trulch to regulate the volume, or he was going to take a personal interest in seeing Trulch suffer. Hal bounced the ball three times, tossed, rocked farther back on the toss, and absolutely crunched the serve, spineless and wickedly angled out wide, Stice grotesquely off balance, lunging too far and hitting the backhand cramped, down the line and shallow. Hal moved in to the service line for it, hunched and with his stick cocked up behind him, looking somehow insectile. Stice stood in the middle of the baseline awaiting pace and was helpless when Hal shortened the stroke and dribbled it at an angle cross-court, barely clearing the net and distorted with backspin and falling into the half-meter of fair space the acuteness of the angle allowed.
Helene Cadenza has the greater tennis brain, Poutrincourt said in English.
Hal aced Stice down the center to go up either 2-1 or 3-2 in the third.
The thing you want to know about Hal, babe, is he's got a complete game, Delent said, as the boys changed ends of the court, Stice holding two balls out before him on the face of his racket.
Hal went to the towel again. The children along the bottom tier were leaning left, and then right in tandem, amusing themselves. The apparition with the lens and metal pole was gone overhead.
"What do you want to know, watching juniors at this level?" DeLint says, still back on an elbow, so his upper body was out of sight, and he was just legs and a voice in Steeply's cold ear.
"They all have different strengths, areas of the game they're better at, and you can drown in profiling a match or a player in terms of the different strengths and the number of individual strengths."
"I am not here to profile the boy," Steeply said, but in French again.
DeLint ignored him.
"It's not just the strengths or the number of strengths. It's, do they come together to make a game? How complete is a kid? Has he got a game? Those kids at lunch you gotta meet."
"But not speak to."
"The kid in the idiotic hat, Pemulus. Mike's got great, great volleys. He's a natural at net. Great, great hand-eye. Mike's other strength is he's got the best lob in East Coast Juniors bar none. These are his strengths. The reason both of these kids you're looking at out here right now can beat the living shit out of Pemulus is Pemulus' strengths don't give him a complete game. Volleys are an offensive shot. A lob's a baseliner's weapon, counterpuncher. You can't lob from the net or volley from the baseline."
"He says Michael Pemulus' abilities cancel each other out."
275.
Poutrincourt said in the other ear. DeLint made the small salam of iteration.
"Pemulus' strengths cancel each other out. Now, Todd Postlethwaite, the little kid with the bandage on his nose from the soap and shower slipping thing, Postlethwaite's also got a great lob. And while Pemulus would take him right now on pure age and power, Postlethwaite's the technically superior player with a better future because Todd's built a complete game out of his lob."
"This DeLint is wrong,"
Poutrincourt said in Quebecois, smiling rictally across Steeply at DeLint.
"Because Postlethwaite won't come in to net. Postlethwaite hangs back at any cost, and unlike Pemulus, he works to develop the ground strokes to let him stay back and draw the other guy in and use that venomous lob. Which means at 14 his game, it will never change or grow. And if he grows strong and wishes to attack, he will never be able,"
Poutrincourt said. DeLint displayed so little curiosity about what Poutrincourt inserted that Steeply wondered if he had some French on the sly, and made a private ideogram to this effect. "Postlethwaite's a pure defensive strategist. He's got a gestalt. The term we use here for a complete game is either gestalt or complete game." Stice aced Hal out wide on the ad court again, and the ball got stuck in an interstitial diamond in the chain-link fencing, and Hal had to put his stick down and use both hands to force the thing out. "Maybe for your article, though, the poop on this kid, the punter's brother, Hal can't lob half as good as even Postlethwaite, and compared to Ortho or Mike, his net play's pedestrian. But unlike his brother when he was here, see, Hal's strengths have started to fit together. He's got a great serve, a great return of serve, and great, great ground strokes with great control and great touch, great command of touch and spin. And he can take a defensive player and yank the kid around with his superior control, and he can take an attacking player and use the guy's own pace against him." Hal passed Stice off the backhand down the line, and the ball looked sure to land fair, and then at the last possible second, it veered out. An abrupt, tight curve out of bounds, as if some freak gust came out of nowhere and blew it out. And Stice looked more surprised than Hal did. The punter's brother's face registered nothing as he stood at the ad corner, adjusting something on his strings.
"But perhaps one does attain this, to win. Imagine you. You become just what you have given your life to be. Not merely very good, but the best. The good philosophy of here and shtit, I believe this philosophy of Anfield is more Canadian than American, so you may see I have prejudice, is that you must have also, so leave to one side for a moment the talent and work to become best. That you are doomed if you do not have also within you some ability to transcend the goal.
276.
Transcend the success of the best, if you get to there."
Steeply could see, off in the parking lot behind the hideous, bulging neo-Georgian cube of the Community and Administration building, several small boys carrying and dragging white plastic bags to the nest of dumpsters that abutted the pines at the parking lot's rear. The children, pale and wild-eyed, and conferring among themselves and casting anxious looks across the grounds at the crowd behind the show court.
"Then," Outrancourt said, "and for the ones who do become the étoile, the lucky who become profiled and photographed for readers and in the USA religion make it, they must have something built into them along the path that will let them transcend it, or they are doomed. We see this in experience. One sees this in all obsessive goal-based cultures of pursuit. Look at the Japonois, the suicide rates of their latter years. This task of us at the Anfield is more delicate still, with the... For you, if you attain your étoile, goal, and cannot find some way to transcend the experience of having that goal be your entire existence, your raison de faire...
277.
So then, one of two things we see will happen.
Steeply had to keep breathing on the pen to keep the point thawed.
One is that you attain the goal and realize the shocking realization that attaining the goal does not complete or redeem you, does not make everything for your life okay, as you are in the culture educated to assume it will do this goal. And then you face this fact that what you had thought would have the meaning does not have the meaning when you get it. And you are impaled by shock. We see suicides in history by people at these pinnacles. The children here are versed in what is called the Saga of Eric Clipperton.
With two P's?
Just so. Or the other possibility of doom for the étoile who attain. They attain the goal, thus, and put as much equal passion into celebrating their attainment as they had put into pursuing the attainment. This is called here the syndrome of the endless party. The celebrity, money, sexual behaviors, drugs and substances, the glitter. They become celebrities instead of players. And because they are celebrities, only as long as they feed the culture of goals hunger for the make it, the winning, they are doomed. Because you cannot both celebrate and suffer. And play is always suffering. Just so.
Our best boy is better than Hal. You'll see him play tomorrow if you want. John Wayne. No relation to the real John Wayne. A fellow compatriot of Terry here.
Aubrey DeLint was sitting back up beside them, the cold giving his pitted cheeks a second flush. Two feverish harlequin ovals.
John Wayne's got a gestalt because Wayne simply got everything, and everything with him's got the sort of pace that a touch artist and thinker like Hal just can't handle.
This was the founder's philosophy, too, of doom. The punter Incandenza's father, who also, I am being told, dabbled in filming?
Steeply asked the Canadian. Outrancourt's shrug could have meant too many things to note.
I came after. Monsieur Stitt. His different goal for the étoile is to walk between these.
Nor did Steeply quite notice the woman's shifts between dialects.
To map out some path between needing the success and mockery-making of the success.
Dillant leaned in. Wayne's got everything. Hal's strength has become knowing he doesn't have everything, and constructing a game as much out of what's missing as what's there. Steeply pretended to arrange the cap, but was really adjusting the wig.
It all sounds awfully abstract for something so physical.
Outrancourt's shrug pushed her glasses slightly up.
It is contradictory. Two selves, one not there. Monsieur Stitt, when the Academy founder died.
The punter's father who dabbled in films.
Steeply's raglan sweater had been his wife's. Again, nodding blandly, Outrancourt.
This academic founder, Monsieur Stitt, tells that this founder was a student of types of sight.
Dillon said, Wayne's only possible limits being also his strength. The tungsten steel will and resolve, the insistence on imposing his game and his will on his man, totally unwilling to change the pace of his game if he's not doing good. Wayne's got the touch and the lobs to hang back on an off day, but he won't. If he's down or things aren't going his way, he just hits harder.
His pace is so overwhelming he can get away with being uncompromising about attack against North American juniors. But in the show, which Wayne will go pro maybe as soon as next year, in the show, flexibility is more important, he'll find. Humility. Poutrincourt was looking at Steeply almost too carelessly, it almost seemed.
The studying was not so much how one sees a thing, but this relation between oneself and what one sees. He translated this numerously across different fields, Monsieur Stetels.
The son described his father as, quote, genre dysphoric.
Poutrincourt cocked her head.
This does not sound like Owl in Condensa.
Delint sniffed meatily. But Wayne's gestalt's chief edge over Hal is the head. Wayne is pure force. He doesn't feel fear, pity, remorse. When a point's over, it might as well have never happened. For Wayne. Hal actually has finer ground strokes than Wayne. And he could have Wayne's pace if he wanted. But the reason Wayne is 3 continentally and Hal's 6 is the head. Hal looks just as perfectly dead out there, but he's more vulnerable in terms of, like, emotionally. Hal remembers points, senses trends in a match. Wayne doesn't. Hal's susceptible to fluctuations, discouragement, set long lapses in concentration. Some days you can almost see Hal, like, flit in and out of a match, like some part of him leaves and hovers and then comes back. The Trolch person said, "Holy crow!"
So to survive here for later is, finally, to have it both ways.
Terry Poutrincourt said quietly, in nearly accentless English, as if to herself. This emotional susceptibility in terms of forgetting being more commonly a female thing. Shtid and I think it's a will issue. Susceptible wills are more common to the top girls here. We see it in Longley. We see it in Millie Kent and Franny Unwin. We don't see this forgetful will in the Vaughts, or in Spodek, who you can watch if you want. The Trolch person said, "Could we see that again, Ray, do you think?" Steeply was looking at the side of Poutrincourt's face as Delint on the other side was saying, "But the one we see this most in is Hal." The 14th of November, year of the Depend Adult Undergarment. The Man-O-War Grill on Prospect. Maddie sat in the hot clatter of the Portuguese restaurant with his hands in his lap, looking at nothing. A waiter brought his soup. The waiter had bits of either bloodstain or soup on his apron, and for no discernible reason wore a fez. Maddie ate his soup without once slurping. He'd been the neat eater in the family. Maddie Pemulis was a prostitute, and today he was 23. The Man-O-War Grill is on Prospect Street in Cambridge, and its front windows overlook the heavy foot traffic between Inman and Central Squares. As Maddie waited for his soup, he'd seen across the restaurant and out the front's glass a bag lady type, older female in several clothing layers, lift her skirts and lower herself to the pavement and move her scaggly old bowels right there in full view of passers-by and diners both, then gather all her plastic shopping bags together and walk stolidly out of view. The pile of bowel movement sat there on the pavement, steaming slightly. Maddie'd heard the college kids at the next table say they didn't know whether to be totally illed or totally awed. A big rangy kid with a big sharp face and tight short hair and a smile and a shave-twice jaw since he was 14, now balding smoothly back from a high, clear forehead. A permanent smile that always seemed like he was trying not to, but just couldn't help it. His da always formally saying to wipe it off. Inman Square. Little Lisbon. The soup has bits of calamari that make the muscles in his face flex, chewing. Now 2 Brazilians in bell-bottoms and tall shoes along the sidewalk, across the window over the diner's heads. What might be a brewing street fight. One walking forward and one walking backward, facing off as they move, each missing the dollop of bowel movement on the walk, speaking high-volume street Portuguese, muffled by windows and hot clatter, but each looking around and then pointing at his own chest like, "You saying this shit to me?" Then the forward man's sudden charge carrying them both past the window's right frame. Matty's dad come over on a boat from Louth in Leinster in 1989. Matty'd been 3 or 4. Dodd worked on the Southie docks, coiling lengths of rope as big around as phone poles into tall cones, and had died when Matty was 17 of pancreatic complaints. Matty looked up from the roll he was dipping in the soup and saw 2 underweight, interracial girls moving across the window. One, a nigger. Neither even looking at the shit everyone stepping around. And then a few seconds behind them, poor Tony Krause, who, because of the trousers and cap, Matty didn't even recognize as poor Tony Krause, until he'd looked back down and then up again. Poor Tony Krause looked god-awful. Sucked out. Hollow-eyed, past ill, grave-ready. His face's skin the greenish-white of extreme-depth marine life. Looking less alive than undead. Identifiable as poor old poor Tony. Only by the boa, and red leather coat, and the certain way he held his hand to his throat's hollow as he walked. That way, Equus Reis always said always reminded him of black-and-white era starlets descending curved stairs into some black tie function, Krause never so much walking as making an infinite series of grand entrances into pocket after pocket of space. A queenly hauteur, now both sickening and awesome given Krause's spectral mien, passing across the grill's window, his eyes either on or looking right through the 2 skinny girls plodding ahead of him. Following them out of the window's right-hand side. His dad begun fucking Matty up the ass when Matty was 10. A fookin' to boom. Matty had complete recall of the whole thing. He'd seen sometimes where persons that had unpleasant things happen to them as children blot the unpleasantness out in their mentality as adults and forgot it. Not so with Matty Pemulis. He remembered every inch and pimple of every single time. His father outside the little room Matt and Mickey slept in, late at night. The cat's eye sliver of lit hallway through the crack in the door Dodd opened. The door on well-oiled hinges opening with the implacable slowness of a rising moon. Dodd's shadow lengthening across the floor, and then the man, his very self, weaving in behind it. Crossing the moonlit floor in darned socks, and that smell about him that later Matty'd know was malt liquor, but at that age he and Mickey called something else when they smelled it. Matty lay and pretended to sleep. He didn't know why tonight he pretended not to know the man was there. He was afraid. Even the first time. Mickey, just 5. All the times were the same. Da, drunk. Tacking across the bedroom floor, a certain stealth. Managing somehow never to break his neck on the toy trucks and tiny cars scattered on the floor, left there that first time by accident. Sitting on the edge of the bed so his weight changed the bed's angle. A big man smelling of tobacco and something else. His breath always audible when drunk. Sitting on the edge of the bed, shaking Matty awake, to the point where Matty'd had to pretend to wake up. Asking if he'd been asleep. Sleeping, there, was he. Tenderness. Caresses that were somehow just over the line from true ethnic Irish fatherly affection. The emotional largesse of a man without a green card, who daily broke his back for his family's food. Caresses that were in some vague way just over the line from that, and from the emotional largesse of something else, drunk, when all the rules of mood were suspended, and you never knew from minute to minute whether you were to be kissed or hit. Impossible to say how, or even know how, they were just over those lines. But they were, the caresses. Tenderness, caresses, low, soft, oversweet, hot, bad breath. Soft apologies for some flash of savagery or discipline from the day. A way of cupping the pillow-warm cheek and jaw in the hollow of the hand. The huge pinky finger, tracing the hollow between throat and jaw. Matty'd shrink away. Shy, are we soon? Scared, are we? Matty'd shrink away, even after he knew the shrinking fear was part of what brought it on, for Dodd get angry. Who are we scared of, then? Then who are we, a son, to be scared so of our own da? As if the da that broke daily his back were nothing more than a... Can't a doll show his son some love without being taken for a... As if Matty could lie here with his food inside him under bedding he'd paid for, and think his doll were no better than a...
Is it a fucking you're scared of, then?
You think a doll what comes in?
To speak to his son, and holds him as a doll has naught on his mind but the fook. As if the son were some $40 whore off the docks. As if the doll were a... Is that what you take me for? Is that what you take me for, then?
Matty shrinking back into a flattening pillow, the Dodd paid for. The springs of the convertible bed singing with his fear. He shook.
Why then? So then I've a mind to give you just what you're thinking to fear. Take me for.
Matty knew early on that his being afraid fueled the thing somehow, made his doll want to. He was unable not to be afraid. He tried and tried, cursed himself for a coward and deserving, all but calling his father a... It was years before he snapped to the fact that his dad have fucked him into boom, no matter what he'd done. That the event was laid out before the first slim line of doorlight broadened, and whatever Matty'd felt or betrayed made no difference. An advantage to not blocking it out is you can snap to things later, with maturer perspective. You can come to see that no soon on the planet could in any way ask for that, regardless. At a certain later age, he started lying there, when his dog shook him and pretended to sleep on, even when the shakes got to where his teeth clacked together, in a mouth that wore the slight smile Matty'd decided truly sleeping people's faces always wore. The harder his father shook him, the tighter Matty'd shut his eyes, and the more set the slight smile, and the louder the rasps of the cartoon snores he alternated with exhaled whistles. Mickey, over in the cot by the window, always silent as a tomb, on his side, face to the wall and hidden. Never a word between them about anything more than the chances of being kissed versus hit. Finally, Dodd grabbed both his shoulders and flipped him over with a sound of disgust and frustration. Matty thought just the smell of the fear was maybe enough to deserve it. Until, later on, he got some maturer perspective. He remembered the oval sound of the cap coming off the jar of petroleum jelly. That special stone-in-pond plop of a Vaseline cap. Not childproof, even in an era of childproof caps. Hearing his dog muttering as he applied it to himself. Feeling the ice-cold, awful cold finger between him as his dog smeared the stuff roughly around Matty's rosebud. His dark star. It was only the maturer perspective of years and experience that let Matty find something to be thankful for. That the Dodd at least used a lube. The origins of the big man's clear familiarity with the stuff, and its nighttime use, not even adult perspective could illuminate. Let Matty snap too, still, now, at 23. One hears, say, cirrhosis and acute pancreatitis, and thinks of the subject clutching his middle like an old film's gut-shot actor, and slumping quietly over to eternal rest with lids shut and face composed. Matty's Dodd died choking on aspirated blood, a veritable fountain of the darkest possible blood. Matty coated a spray paint russet as he held the man's yellow wrists, and Mum lumbered off down the ward in search of a crash cart team. Particles aspirated so terribly fine, like almost atomized, so that they hung in the air like the air itself over the cribbed bed as the man expired. Cat-yellow eyes wide open, and face screwed into the very most god-awful, rictusized grin of pain. His last thoughts, if any, unknowable. Matty still toasted the man's final memory with his first shot, whenever he indulged.
278.
The 11th of November, year of the Depend Adult Undergarment. First thing after supper, Hal drops around to Stitt's room off the ComEd lobby to go through the motions of getting some input on just what had gone so terribly wrong against Stice. Also to get, maybe, some kind of bead on why he'd had to play the darkness publicly in the first place, so close to the Whataburger. That is, like, what the exhibition might have signified. This endless tension among ETAs about how the coaches are seeing you. Gauging your progress. Is your stock going up or down? But A. DeLint's the only one in there, working on some sort of oversized, spread sheetish chart, lying prone and shirtless on the bare floor, with his chin in his hand and a pungent magic marker, and says Shtid has gone off on the cycle somewhere after confections, but to sit down. Presumably meaning in a chair. So Hal's subjected to several minutes of Delint's take on the match, complete with stats out of the prorector's head. Delint's back is pale and constellated with red pits of old pimples, though the back's nothing compared to Strux's or Shaw's back. There's a cane chair and a wood chair. Delint's liquid crystal laptop screen pulses grayly on the floor next to him. Shtit's room's overlit, and there's no dust anywhere, not even in the very corners. Shtit's sound system's lights are on, but nothing's playing. Neither Hal nor Delint mentions Orin's profiler's presence in the match's stands, nor the big lady's long interchange with Putrancourt, which had been conspicuous. Stice's and Wayne's names are at the top of the huge chart on the floor, but Hal's name isn't. Hal says he can't tell whether he's made some sort of basic tactical error, or whether he just wasn't quite up to snuff this afternoon or what. "You just never quite occurred out there, kid," Delint apprises him. He has regressed certain figures to back this up, this non-occurrence. His choice of words chills Hal to the root. After which, during what's supposed to be mandatory PM study period, and despite the three chapters of board's prep his board's prep schedule calls for, Hal sits alone up in viewing room 6, the bad leg out along the couch in front of him, flexing the bad ankle idly, holding the other leg's knee to his chest, squeezing a ball but with the hand he doesn't play with, chewing Kodiak and spitting directly into an unlined wastebasket, his expression neutral, watching some cartridges of his late father's entertainments. Anyone else looking at him in there tonight would call Hal depressed. He watches several cartridges all in a row. He watches The American Century as Seen Through a Brick, and Prenuptial Agreement of Heaven and Hell, and then part of Valuable Coupon Has Been Removed, which is maddening because it's all a monologue from some bespectacled little contemporary of Miles Penn and Heath Pearson, who was almost as ubiquitous as Reet and Bain in himself's work, but whose name right now Hal can't for the life of him recall. He watches parts of Death in Scarsdale, and Union of Publicly Hidden in Lynn, and Various Small Flames, and Kinds of Pain. The viewing room has insulated paneling behind the wallpaper and is essentially soundproof. Hal watches half of the Medusa versus Odalisque thing, but takes it out abruptly when people in the audience start getting turned to stone. Hal tortures himself by imagining swarthy, leering types threatening to torture various loved ones if Hal can't come up with the name of the kid in Valuable Coupon and Low Temperature Civics and Wave Bye-Bye to the Bureaucrat. There are two cartridges on VR6's glass shelves of himself getting interviewed in various arty community access cable-type forums, which Hal declines to watch. The light's slight flicker and subtle change in the pressure of the room is from the ETA furnaces kicking on way down in the tunnels below ComEd. Hal shifts uneasily on the couch, spitting into the waste can. The very faint smell of burnt dust is also from the furnace. A minor short didactic one Hal likes and runs twice in a row is Wave Bye-Bye to the Bureaucrat. A bureaucrat in some kind of sterile fluorescent-lit office complex is a fantastically efficient worker when awake, but he has this terrible problem waking up in the AM and is consistently late to work, which in a bureaucracy is idiosyncratic and disorderly and wholly unacceptable, and we see this bureaucrat getting called into a supervisor's pebbled glass cubicle, and the supervisor, who wears a severely dated leisure suit with his shirt collar flaring out on either side of its rust-colored lapels, tells the bureaucrat that he's a good worker and a fine man, but that this chronic tardiness in the AM is simply not going to fly. And if it happens one more time, the bureaucrat is going to have to find another fluorescent-lit office complex to work in. It's no accident that in a bureaucracy getting fired is called termination, as in ontological erasure. And the bureaucrat leaves his supervisor's cubicle, duly shaken. That night, he and his wife go through their Bauhaus condominium, collecting every alarm clock they own, each one of which is electric and digital and extremely precise, and they festoon their bedroom with them. So there are like a dozen timepieces with their digital alarms all set for 0615 hours. But that night, there's a power failure, and all the clocks lose an hour or just sit there blinking 0100 hours over and over. And the bureaucrat still oversleeps the next AM. He wakes late, lies there for a moment staring at a blinking 0000. He shrieks, clutches his head, throws on wrinkled clothes, ties his shoes in the elevator, shaves in the car, blasting through red lights on the way to the commuter rail. The 0816 train to the city pulls into the station's lower level, just as the crazed bureaucrat's car screeches into the station's parking lot, and the bureaucrat can see the top of the train sitting there, idling from across the open lot. This is the very last temporally feasible train. If the bureaucrat misses this train, he'll be late again. And terminated. He hauls into a handicapped spot and leaves the car there at a crazy angle, vaults the turnstile, and takes the stairs down to the platform seven at a time, sweaty and bug-eyed. People scream and dive out of his way. As he careers down the long stairway, he keeps his crazed eyes on the open doors of the 0816 train, willing them to stay open just a little longer. Finally, filmed in a glacial slow-mo, the bureaucrat leaps from the seventh to the bottom step and lunges toward the train's open doors, and right in mid-lunge, smashes headlong into an earnest-faced little kid with thick glasses and a bow tie and those nerdy little schoolboy shorts, who's tottering along the platform under a tall armful of carefully wrapped packages. Ker-wham! They collide. Bureaucrat and kid both stagger back from the impact. The kid's packages go flying all over the place. The kid recovers his balance and stands there, stunned, glasses and bow tie askew.
279.
The bureaucrat looks frantically from the kid to the litter of packages, to the kid, to the train's doors, which are still open. The train thrums. Its interior is fluorescent lit and filled with employed, ontologically secure bureaucrats. You can hear the station's PA announcer saying something tinny and garbled about departure. The stream of platform foot traffic opens around the bureaucrat and the stunned boy and the litter of packages. Ogilvied once lectured for a whole period on this kid's character as an instance of the difference between an antagonist and a deuteragonist in moral drama. He'd mentioned the child actor's name over and over. Hal tries thwacking himself just over the right eye several times to dislodge the name. The film's bureaucrat's buggy eyes keep going back and forth between the train's open doors and the little kid, who's looking steadily up at him, almost studious, his eyes big and liquid behind the lenses. Hal doesn't remember who played the bureaucrat either. But it's the kid's name that's driving him bats. The bureaucrat's leaning away, inclined way over toward the train doors, as if his very cells were being pulled that way. But he keeps looking at the kid, the gifts, struggling with himself. It's a clear internal conflict moment, one of himself's film's very few. The bureaucrat's eyes suddenly recede back into their normal places in his sockets. He turns from the fluorescent doors and bends to the kid, and asks if he's okay, and says it'll all be okay. He cleans the kid's spectacles with his pocket handkerchief, picks the kid's packages up. About halfway through the packages, the PA issues something final, and the train's doors close with a pressurized hiss. The bureaucrat gently loads the kid back up with packages, neatens them. The train pulls out. The bureaucrat watches the train pull out, expressionless. It's anybody's guess what he's thinking. He straightens the kid's bow tie, kneeling down the way adults do when they're ministering to a child, and tells him he's sorry about the impact and that it's okay. He turns to go. The platform's mostly empty now. Now, the strange moment. The kid cranes his neck around the packages and looks up at the guy as he starts to walk away.
"Mister," the kid says, "are you Jesus?"
"Don't I wish," the ex-bureaucrat says over his shoulder, walking away, as the kid shifts the packages and frees one little hand to wave by at the guy's top coat's back as the camera, revealed now as mounted on the 0816's rear, recedes from the platform and picks up speed. Wave bye-bye to the bureaucrat remains Mario's favorite of all their late father's entertainments, possibly because of its unhip earnestness. Though to Mario he always maintains it's basically goo, Hal secretly likes it too, the cartridge, and likes to project himself imaginatively into the ex-bureaucrat's character on the leisurely drive home toward ontological erasure. As a kind of weird self-punishment, Hal also plans to subject himself to the horrific Fun with Teeth and Baby Pictures of Famous Dictators. Then finally to one of himself's posthumous hits, a cartridge called Blood Sister, One Tough Nun, that he'd always found kind of gratuitously nasty and overwrought, but which Hal has no idea that this piece of entertainment actually germinated out of James O. Incandenza's one brief and unpleasant experience with Boston AA in the BS mid-90s, when himself lasted 2.5 months and then drifted gradually away, turned off by the simplistic God stuff and covert dogma. Bob hopeless, Hal spits way more than is his norm now, and also likes having the waste can right nearby in case he might throw up. That afternoon, he'd had zilch in the way of a kinesthetic sense. He couldn't feel the ball on his stick. His nausea has nothing to do with watching his father's cartridges. For the last year, his arm's been an extension of his mind, and the stick an extension of the arm, acutely sensitive. Each of the cartridges is a carefully labeled black diskette. They're all signed neatly out on the clipboard by the egg-shaped glass bookshelf, and are loaded in the queuing slots, and waiting to drop, in order, and be digitally decoded. The 14th of November, year of the Depend Adult Undergarment. P.T. Krause, North Cambridge. That infamous, deceptive post-seizure feeling of well-being. That broken fever, reversal of fortune type, high-hearted feeling after a neuroelectric event. Poor Tony Krause awoke in the ambulance, lizardless and continent, and feeling right as rain. Lay there and flirt.